Welcome to another virtual edition of Elaine's Literary Salon podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey James Higgins. My wife, Cynthia, and I have turned her award-winning restaurant into a literary salon, which is a safe place for authors in the Washington, D.C. area. We've become a hub for writers of all types in Washington. We celebrate book clubs, writing groups, critique groups, workshops, anything literary related. I'm excited today. We have an author coming in to talk about history. He is the 191st author since we started interviewing people. You can find our upcoming schedule at elainesliterarysalon.com. We have at least one a week, and some weeks we have up to four or five. So today I'm interviewing Dr. Justin Laborde, who is my 191st author at our salon. A published author, communications scholar, strategic consultant, and frequent speaker on consumer trends, marketplace insights, and business growth strategies at Fortune 500 companies, Dr. Laborde brings to this project a passion for history and a researcher's training. For the past 19 years, he has worked as a strategic consultant and thought leadership vice president for the global firms of Cantor and Ipsos. As part of his work, he is a frequent guest speaker presenting at client events and industry conferences. Justin has a lifelong passion for military history in general and the theaters and battles of the Second World War more specifically. He has a BA in English from Washington and Lee University, as well as an MS in integrated marketing and management communications, and a doctorate in mass communications focusing on statistical methods and social science research and research methodologies from Florida State University. His first book, Scattered Far and Wide, the Naval Academy Class of 38 at War, was published by the Naval Institute Press in September of 2025. Justin was raised in New Orleans, Louisiana, and now lives with his wife, Amanda, and their three children in Cary, North Carolina. Dr. Laborde, welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Really excited to be here. Appreciate it. Thank you.
So I've been a sort of a World War II buff since I was a little kid, so I certainly enjoy that. Why don't you give us just a little back jacket copy here? What is your book about?
So the book is about literally the class of 1938 from the Naval Academy. And so they graduate at this time where there are rumblings of a war coming, but nobody really knows for sure what's going to happen. And then roughly 2.5, 3 years later, the war starts. And they, by that time, had had a couple of years in the fleet, had had a couple of years to become submarine officers or become flight officers and aviators. And so the war starts and they're junior enough to really be on the front lines, but senior enough to kind of start having some command responsibility, which turned out to just be the perfect timing for a lot of really good stories about the Naval Academy, about these midshipmen, about the war in general. And, you know, so that was kind of ultimately what drove me to do this. But the real impetus for this project was my grandfather, Alden Laborde, was a member of that class. And honestly, I always had a passion for World War II, always had a passion for military history, always knew I wanted to someday write a book. And I was paging through a copy of his 1938 yearbook from the Naval Academy, looking at his picture, looking at all the other pictures, just started to wonder what happened to these guys during the war. They graduate and it's right before the war starts. So that was kind of the initial idea. And it really kind of evolved from there into this story of 21, 22 different graduates from that year, and the stories of their service in the war and what happened to them. And it encompasses a lot. So it was a nice way to kind of tell the story of World War II from a bit of a different perspective, I thought.
So I love that, by the way. It's a really cool motivation, your personal connection to it.
Yeah.
But what is it, do you think, that makes you actually want to, like, you see, you have this curiosity, what happened to these guys? And right. And obviously it was, you know, you're in your family history, but what would you say you've always liked history? Like, what is it about history that makes you want to dig into it and bring something to the, for a contemporary audience?
Well, you know, I think there's still so much that we can learn about not just World War II, but all of the historical events that have happened. There's no end to the stories that we can tell, whether it's World War II, World War I, Vietnam, the Great Depression, really pick a time. And I know there are a lot of books that have been written, but I just think even when it comes to World War II, there's still so many stories that haven't been told. And I think they deserve to be told. I think the service that these guys performed during the war, even if it wasn't massively exciting, it was still important, still laudable, and still should be told. And so I tried to tell as many stories as I could, and I tried to pick a sample of service that they performed, theater that they performed in, battles that they performed. Honestly, I wish I could have told all 470 something stories of what happened, but I couldn't. But again, I think it just goes back to what these folks did was so laudable and so admirable that their stories, I thought, deserved to be told, and in many instances hadn't been told yet. And I think what that can do today is just remind us of the Americans who, in generations before us, really risked everything for the future of our country, for us today. And whether that's World War II, whether that's the Revolutionary War, whether that's the Civil War, those individuals put aside their lives to really help their country, not just at that time, but also future generations for us. And I just think it has always inspired me, and it still does. And so any small part that I can play and recognizing the service of those who have come before us and those who have come today, who are serving today, it needs to be done, is kind of how I feel about it.
Well, thank you for doing that, and I agree with you, and it certainly does. Do you think because we have a volunteer army now that people look at that sacrifice in a different way? Like, do you think they're able to understand what that means, getting drafted, and so many people just volunteered for that war too,
Yeah,
right? Uh, that that
absolutely.
that sort of patriotism and national identity, especially in a time when things are so partisan here. Do you think it resonates the same way with like young people today?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I got to tell you, I have been at book signings where some people have kind of looked at the book and looked at the subject matter, and I could tell had a bit of a reservation about what I was trying to do. Maybe, and I think, honestly, because America is such a divided place today, really so fragmented today. And they were wondering if perhaps my book was, maybe too jingoistic or, I don't know, overly right wing. I don't know, but that's not my intention at all. And I think it does, it is an interesting time to be doing this. What honestly I have found is that to be writing this kind of a book today is a balm for a lot of people. It reminds a lot of people that, the country doesn't have to be so divided. There were times when we came together for the greater good, for the world's benefit. And so, I know a lot of books today about the war, about previous wars, about history of the United States are really resonating with people because it's just a place they can go back to and remind themselves that what's happening today didn't always happen and hopefully won't happen moving forward. And again, in terms of the discord that we're seeing, in terms of the division that we're seeing. So I think it strikes a chord. And you mentioned something interesting, the all-volunteer army. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there was a draft during World War II. Everybody that I write about at the Naval Academy volunteered to go join the Naval Academy. Now, they did so at a time when they didn't know war was coming. They did so at a time when we were fairly peaceful, early 1930s. What really I find so moving today is that when I go to the academy, any of the academies, or talk to any service people, they joined the war at a time when war was not only possible, but either going on or likely. The midshipmen at the Naval Academy today are just really wonderful people who know that they could potentially be in the front lines of some pretty dangerous situations. I find that so, again, so moving. And I just love talking to those kinds of audiences. But there's a lot going on in the world today. And for those folks today to volunteer to serve this country that is so fractured and divisive, that seems to have so many issues, right, left, conservative, liberal, they're putting all that aside and saying, I love this country regardless of all of this. I want to protect it. And again, it just moves me every time I talk to these people and these folks.
It's a great point, and I mean, it's an interesting sort of psychological phenomenon too. And because of this volunteer army, you have people who know they're not going to war, right? But I mean, you have to have an army, and people have to be protected. There's a lot of evil in the world, as we see all the time,
All the
But
time.
and then a dedicated group of people. It's interesting. It'd be interesting to look at the people who volunteer and see what their motivations are and where that's coming from and how they were raised. I know part of it is a lack of understanding of history. I mean, I see these polls have been going on for decades, but I think the last poll I saw was something like 8% of eighth graders were at read history or testing at history at grade level. And it was sort of different for all ages, but overall, I think it was something like 20 or 30% were at grade level. I mean, it was just ridiculous, like that they wouldn't even know their own country's history.
I know, and I agree with you. That can be somewhat really sad from time to time. I do go talk to schools. I have done that a number of times, and they may not know all the details, but all the students I've talked to love the stories and are fascinated by the stories. And so I can get up there and tell them about, Ernie Cody and what happened to him on the blimp, the L8, or I can get up and talk about Dusty Cleese and what happened to him at Midway. And the stories are so exciting and so riveting. Even these students who don't have the grasp of history that I think you and I would wish they did still just really enjoy the stories and are amazed that these things actually happened. So school groups are fun to talk to. As long as you're not assuming that they have a thorough grounding in history that we would like, they're fun because they enjoy these stories that we have to tell about what happened in history.
Well, I definitely want to get into the meat of your book, but before I do that, let's stay at that 40,000 foot level for a second. Was when you didn't have a contract when you were writing this book, correct? So
Right.
how do you stay motivated? Like, because first off, how long did it take you from start to finish? You're like, okay, I'm going to write this book, and you start researching. Like, how long from beginning to you actually had something you could submit to a publisher?
Well, that's a great question. So it took me, I think all in all, I did the math the other day. It took me about 7 years to do the research and to write the book. Took that That's a long time. Now, it was a long time because it was my first one, so I didn't really know how to do it. I didn't even understand, what word count would be appropriate for a history book. I didn't understand how to had so much good information. I thought I'm just going to put it all in there. So the thing got very bloated very quickly when I was writing it. Turns out it probably could have been done in 3 or 4 years if I knew what I was doing. But honestly, Jeffrey, I did it because I just love every aspect of it. I love the writing. As an English major, I've always enjoyed writing. That was always extremely fun, and I just love the research. I love getting into the archives. I love going to old libraries. I'm one of those kind of people that just finds that a lot of fun. But I also had a job, and at the time I was raising young kids, so I could only work on it for maybe 2 or 3 hours a night. So that also added to the time. But I didn't have a contract, so I had no idea what was going to happen to this book that I was putting together. And frankly, nothing could have happened. So I had to be okay with that. And honestly, I never really let it bother me. I'd work my 9 to 5 job. I would help out with the kids in the evening. We would get them to bed. And then I would sort of retreat to working on this project. And it was a great stress reliever. And it was just something I really enjoyed. And so, as long as you don't tell people that you're writing a book, I find that the expectations aren't high. So it was something I could just kind of do. And like you said, it took a long time. The next one that I do is going to go a lot shorter because I know how to do it. But so then, I had a book. I had a book after about 7 years. I had something that I could do something with, and so I reached out to some agents and kind of went that route. And then ultimately, what I did was submitted it myself to the Naval Institute Press, which is a book that publishes military history, naval history for the most part. It's actually located on the grounds of Annapolis. I thought they might be interested, and turns out they were, and I have to give them all the credit. They've responded to my unsolicited email, and we kind of went from there. And the whole thing has just been a dream come true. It really, really has.
I
It's been
love that.
great.
It's congratulations, first of all. It's
Thank
such a
you.
big idea to finish a book. Like, it's, roughly 80% of people say they want to write a book, only 3% ever start and 1% ever finish. And then it's a fraction of that 1% who actually get published, right? So, but I don't want to gloss over what you said, because we have a lot of authors who listen to this podcast, and you're talking about the joy of writing, and you love researching, and you are just, not telling too many people. And like, people forget, because writing is an art. And when, if you're playing the guitar at home or something, no one ever goes, well, where's your next stadium venue? You know, like, but with authors, for some reason, it's all like, you know, well, who's your publisher? Is it a bestseller? Have I heard of you? You know, like they expect everyone to be at the top of their profession. And I that's such a trap for authors, right? Because if you tie yourself to like commercial success, it's so hard to break out. There were 4 million books in 2025 that came out, 32% increase over 2024. You know, if you're trying, the number of people, even with like the big five publishing houses that break out of that, is just a minuscule number of authors. But what you're doing and enjoying the process and loving what you're doing and believing in the cause, like that's the whole thing. That's win or lose, right? Whether 10 million people read the book or 100. You won because you won through the enjoyment of the
I
process.
couldn't agree more. And you have to, I think you have to be that way to make all this work. You have to enjoy the process, be comfortable if nothing happens. You know, I was going to bind it myself and give it off to some family members if that would, and that would have been okay, I think, you know. But to have it published, I always said my dream was to see my name on a book. It's been published. It's a beautiful cover jacket. It's in Barnes and Noble. Just to see it in the shelves at Barnes and Noble was such a treat. But you know, not to kind of go down this rabbit hole, Jeffrey, but that's why I don't really understand AI. And I know authors use AI and can use it effectively. I never wanted to use it for the research because I love the research. Why would I want to outsource the research? I never would have even imagined trying to use it for writing because that's the most fun part of the process to me. So AI has not really ever entered into my sort of worldview of how to approach this process. And I'm not sure that it ever will. I say that now, but who knows? I don't know. A lot of authors have different attitudes towards AI, but that's kind of my approach. It's just the process to me is so much fun that I guess that's why I do it. You know, whether I have a bestseller someday or not, I think I'll always do it because that's just a part of me that I feel needs to kind of express itself. And it's just a way for me to enjoy myself. And it's a fun hobby that I have. And it's actually materialized into something, which is exciting.
I'll say in a very big way. There are two things with using it to research is, in a way, it's just like the same way people would Google something as a starting point, right? And then find the source documents. But the writing itself is so problematic because, for one, you can't copyright it, right? That's a big deal. A lot of eventually these platforms will have to ban or at least segregate AI from non-AI, but it's the only way they'll be so flooded, probably this year. We'll probably jump from like 4 to 6 million books this year is my prediction. And then
Oh my gosh.
it's going to be so out of control that they'll have to literally any AI, they'll have to push it to the side. But most the scariest part, you talk about enjoying the writing of this. There were three studies that came out within the last year, and they showed people who were like writing fully with AI, like giving it a prompt and letting it write, those who are using it as like a writing partner, and those who are using it for more research and like to help with them figure things out. And they were able to see changes in their synaptic connections in their creative centers of their brain. So the more you used it, the less creative you physically became, you know? And I can't imagine damaging my creativity over like 5 years, say. Like that's the whole thing. That's the gift that you have, right? Why would you want to destroy that?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I'd like to think that I have a voice, a way of writing that's somewhat unique, hopefully. Why would I want to have AI sort of mellow that out and flatten that out? I just don't understand it. Now, again, I'm sure people use it and use it effectively and they have figured it out. And maybe I'm just one of those folks who's too afraid to try. I don't know, but I just really enjoy it. It's a creative outlet for me. I'm not sure what I would replace it with if I didn't do that. So I just like to do it on my own and kind of hone this craft that you mentioned and hone this creativity that has taken a long time to kind of get to a point where I'm pretty happy with it,
It's
frankly.
incredibly hard because people read and they think, oh, how hard can that be? That's why everyone thinks they're going to write a book. What about the process of the actual writing? Maybe not the research because you sort of do that anyhow, right? But the actual writing, what about that was harder or more unexpected?
So I think if I was writing for myself or for family, the way I would write would almost sort of be almost like a Jack Kerouac kind of stream of consciousness, because I find that writing very, very interesting. But if I'm writing for an audience, I've realized it needs to be sharper, it needs to be tighter, it needs to be clear. It needs to be. I wanted to write history. There are a lot of authors who do this, but I wanted to write history in a bit of a lyrical way. I just find Really good writing brings history to life. But it takes me a lot of drafts to get there. My initial drafts are very much, like I said, kind of stream of consciousness and just unpublishable. So, but the revising process is too. It's exhausting. It's a lot of work, as you know, but it is also a fun part of it. But it is a critical part of it, and you almost, I don't see how you rush through the revisions and the revising process. That's where I really feel like the good writing kind of comes out. So my first drafts, it's really just about, okay, what information do I want to get out there? How do I want to structure this chapter? How do I want it to flow? What's the pacing? And the writing is not very good. So then I take some time, read through it over and over and over again, and finally kind of get to a point where, okay, the information is good, the pacing is good, the structure is good, and the word choice is good, the diction is good, the rhythm of the writing is good. And that takes a while to get there, for sure.
Did you figure that out yourself, or were you listening to like writing podcasts? Were you getting writing craft books? Like, because that's really important. You got to the end, getting it on the page. No one's going to see this. I know I have a lot of editing to make it readable, and that is sort of the process, right? Everyone's a little different, but most writers will do that because if a lot of new writers I talk to, they just iterate over that first chapter over and over and over and over again, and they'll never get to the end.
I did it all. I mean, I devour writing podcasts. I love hearing about authors talk about the craft. Before podcasts came along, I would devour books of, interviews with authors and just hear about, for some reason, I love visually seeing their workspaces. So I love those kinds of books. I just love hearing about how other authors do it. And they all kind of seem to say, if there's a common theme or themes that I could point to, it's this idea that you write, you get it down on the page, and then you start to revise and you revise and you revise. And the revising takes a long time and is really, really hard. And it absolutely is. I don't have somebody that I share things with. It's almost because it's an insecurity of mine. And I know a lot of writers have a spouse or a partner or an editor that they work with from the very beginning. And I don't do it that way. I really kind of have to do it myself. Again, because I think it's a bit of an insecurity that I don't want somebody to say, you know what, this is just not working. It's almost like I can't handle that rejection because then I'll ditch the book. So I kind of have to keep it to myself, keep it sort of tight against my chest before I show it to anybody. And then once it's done, then I'll start to share it with people and get some feedback that way. But
Listen,
I think,
everybody's different. Some people like to collaborate more than others. I'm the same way as you. Like, nobody sees it till I've it's good as I
okay,
can get
good.
it, and
So I'm
now I'll
not
just put it
alone.
out there. Yeah, because it's terrible in the early stages. Like, I keep going back. Hopefully, it gets better, right? But when you do these iterations, like, I keep going back and deepening things and changing things. And when it's done, that's when I show it to people.
It's funny. I've noticed that in my first draft, what I do over and over and over again is start a sentence with a parenthetical expression. For some reason, it's just this thing, this crutch that I fall back on every single time. And then you read it on the page and you see it's so obvious. And it's like, why didn't I realize this when I was actually writing the page? But it's just things like that. Writing, everybody has their own approach to it. And I think they're all valid. There is no one way to do it. And there nor should there be. And then there are ways to teach it for sure, ways to talk about it, ways to advise new writers and students about how to do it. But ultimately, I think everybody has to find their own idiosyncratic and unique way of doing it, and nothing is wrong. If it results in a good book, how you got there is totally valid.
Okay, so that caveat is the most important part, right? Because everyone is different, it becomes a crutch for people, and they say, "Well, that's not how my process works." But if your process is not producing a product, then it's not working.
That's right. You have to be making progress, and you're right. I think a lot of people don't get past the first chapter, the first page. A lot of people are deathly afraid of the first page. Honestly, I think that's what's easiest about nonfiction. The research goes first. You have your notes that guide you on the first page, the second page, the third page. Fiction, like what you do, Jeffrey, that would be hard. I mean, when I was in high school and early in college, I thought, oh, I'm going to be a fiction writer, and never really struggled with writer's block, but I'm always sort of at the end of the day, I have the research to fall back on. And that really helps with the structure and the writing process to me, because again, I'm not having to make something up. I'm just telling good stories.
So it helps in the structure, but obviously you have to stay true to facts. So that's way harder, right? And you can't just make things up to fit. But also, like you're talking about being a fiction writer, you also have to impose that structure because people see things in three or four acts or seven acts or whichever structure you believe in. But there's a storytelling structure that humans hear story in. So you still have to take these real facts and find that structure within it, right? There still has to be a beginning, middle, and end. And I promise you, we're going to get into the book. I just there are a few more, because this is your first book. I'm so curious. Like,
Well, I love it. I could do this all day, just talk about process and craft, and I just love it.
when you receive the contract, right? You're not having a lot of luck with agents, which, by the way, is not unusual. They're taking like one out of every 4,000 queries. It's just horrible, right? But when you go to a publisher, what was that like? Would you get an email, phone call? Tell us about that moment.
Well, so I did get an agent, and he was extremely helpful. He advised me on how to do, put a proposal together, and he advised me on he was the one that told me your book is too long. He's the one that told me you got to start, even though this is a nonfiction book, you got to start that first chapter with something that's action-packed and grabs the reader. He was immensely helpful. But once we couldn't sell it to a big publisher, he and I kind of talked about what was next. And actually, I then kind of sat on the book for about 2 years because I wasn't sure what to do next, honestly. And I guess I was thinking, well, maybe I should just self-publish it. But it kind of took 2 years of just sort of sitting on it to, I guess, get the courage up to really say, okay, let's do something else. And then very quickly, I got the writer's handbook and I saw which publishers accepted, sort of unagented writers and unagented queries. And I did the research to pick a publisher I thought might be excited and interested. And I don't know how it got through, but again, I think it was because it was so relevant to that publisher, to the Naval Institute Press, that the query email was interesting enough. Put that proposal together, put that book project together. They liked that. They got it peer reviewed. We shortened it down. They helped with the book jacket. They helped with the blurbs. All of these things I couldn't have done without them. And this being my first book, there was a lot I didn't know. But I had to put it in the right format. I had to work with an editor, which was an interesting experience about, change this word, change this order, change this flow. That was really interesting. Because, and I don't know, I'm sure you've have found this too. Editors are great. They're invaluable. They don't necessarily, at least early on, really know your voice and really know your preferences. So they have to trust you. You have to trust them. But all of that had to be done before, it went off to the printer. And that was a process that took a long time. And it was really educational. It was a lot of fun. It took a long time, so you have to be patient. But once September 2nd of 2025 hit and the book came out, I mean, that was just an amazing day. And I have, like I said, this book with my name on it. That was always the dream, and anything else beyond that's just gravy.
What did it feel like
So,
when that book of author copies showed up?
I came in a box, 10 copies. And my wife was videotaping it on her phone. I guess you don't videotape things anymore, but she was recording it on her phone and recording me opening the box. So I have that and pulling it out and just kind of holding it up. And it was as special as I thought it might be and hoped it would be. It really was just an amazing moment to pull that book out and actually have it in my hands, have that tangible product that was the result of a long, many years of work was just special.
It's emotional. Like I don't
It
think people
really is.
realize how much of you goes into this. And especially, you're working a full-time job and you're doing this in the other time that you could be spending with family or out, playing basketball or whatever it is you do, right? And you put that amount of effort into it. Then you're holding that thing that was previously only in your mind and now it's a tangible object.
And it was really kind of neat to see my wife and my kids' reactions to it because they knew I was working on this book and they didn't know what it meant or what it was or if anything would come of it and actually see the product. They were like, I think their impressions were they were very happy for me. But I think also it was impressive for them. I think that was the most impressed my kids have been by me in all of their lives. The one thing I think that they'll find impressive was holding up that book.
It is impressive. So, like, now that the book's out there, now you have strangers reading your work. Was
Yeah.
there some trepidation there? I mean, what did that feel like to have people outside, like your editor, reading this book? People you don't know are now
Yeah.
reading and evaluating.
It was nerve-wracking. It was I just hope people like it. It was mainly to your point about you can't make anything up when you're writing. At least I can't. I don't think like anybody can or should. I hope nobody finds a mistake. So far they haven't, which I think is really, really good. And I kept very copious notes about where everything came from. Even to the point where, it's like, okay, what did the sky look like that day? I had to have a source for what the sky looked like and what the seas looked like. Nobody found any mistakes yet. I guess it's still possible. And maybe they have found any. I just don't know about it. But that's the scariest part. Yeah. And then you hope people like it and you hope people like the writing. And so far, the feedback has been really, really nice. I have found that some folks are upset I didn't include a relative of theirs in the story in the book, and I kind of always have to say we couldn't include everybody. We had to cut out a lot of really amazing people who told great stories. One of the people we had to cut out was my grandfather. In the initial draft, I had about 150 pages about him and his story. Ultimately, I had to take all that out. So that's kind of been the pushback.
So what do you do with that? Like you have 150 pages on your grandfather. Is that something you're going to put in another book, or is that something you would put in another format, maybe a long form
Yeah.
nonfiction?
I think I could always tell that story. I need to sort of think about how to maybe write essays that are associated with the book or articles associated with the book. I could do it that way. I haven't explored that yet. I know, Jeffrey, you're really, really good at that. What I did with that was frankly just kind of compiled it all into a separate version that I sent to my aunts and uncles and my cousins, which they appreciated and found very interesting. But haven't done more with it. Now, the other stories, God, I would just love to do maybe a version two or something. But what I'm doing now is something entirely different. So maybe down the road I can kind of loop back. But there are just so many more stories about that class, but also about other classes. I could tell, there's stories somebody should do this about West Point, about the Merchant Marine Academy. Those classes right before the war would be amazing stories too. So it's a very rich area, this idea of kind of looking at a class and telling those stories. But yeah, there was so much that was left on the cutting room floor, but I think that's inevitable. I mean, not always, in books like this, it's just kind of, you can't sell a 1,000-page book very easily.
Is
So
that what it was? You mentioned the length a few times. What was your word count
my word
at the
count on
time?
the, it's a great question. My word count on the initial version was 400,000 words.
Oh, yikes.
So I think 100,000 words is what, 300 pages, kind of give or
It's
take?
roughly 250 words per page, but that's if you have a lot of dialogue and things. So if it's denser, with like nonfiction, you might 300 words a page. Yeah.
Oh, and I had no idea that I knew what the page count was of my rough draft. But I was also writing in small font. So that was, it was just, it's a comedy of errors for me going through this process, but I got through
If it makes you feel better, all writers go through that because you're not born knowing this
it.
information. They don't teach it. You know what I mean? Even if you get an MFA, a lot of times they don't talk about the commercial side of the business. So if you're not listening to podcasts, by the way, what were your favorite podcasts? You mentioned you listen to this stuff all the time. What who did you listen to that you found very helpful?
Yeah, so I listen to a variety of different podcasts, but frankly, what I do is I go to my podcast app and I search for a topic. I don't search for a specific podcast, I search for a specific topic. So I have been able to, I'll search for Pat Conroy, or I'll search for James Lee Burke, or I'll search for Rick Atkinson, who's one of my favorite historians, or any, so I kind of, my favorite writers at that time, Alex Kershaw is one of my favorite writers, Simon Winchester. I'll search for the name, which really kind of introduces me to a lot of really interesting and good podcasts. The Pritzker Military Library did a podcast for years and years. They don't do it anymore, but all it was military historians giving speeches and doing interviews. And so I devoured that one. There's one on books on World War II. There's a Preble Hall podcast series that the Naval Academy does that I find really, really good. But you know, I also like just hearing fiction authors talk too, and so I like hearing modern authors talk about their process. So I'll listen to anything, frankly. But yeah, I approach it a bit differently in that it's not the podcast so much as it's the person that's being interviewed that I kind of migrate to.
So how much did you apply? You mentioned modern fiction authors. How much did you apply the craft of fiction to your nonfiction? Because you're telling stories, right? So the pacing that you mentioned earlier, all of that comes into play. How cognizant when you were writing this were you of writing it in a way that would come across like an action thriller?
I was extremely cognizant of that. I knew that the books about the history books that I enjoyed talked about history in a literary sense and really tried to tell the history in the way that stories are told, the way that fiction stories are told. I think if you read my book, hopefully that will become apparent, is that it's written in more of a literary style. Now, there are people that write history and it's very operationally focused. It's all about tactics, it's all about strategy. And that, from what I understand, sells well, but it's not how I wanted to do it. I wanted my history to be almost like a fiction book. And I think it worked. We'll have to kind of see, but on every page, Jeffrey, that's what I was trying to do, was tell these historical events like a fiction writer would. But every detail is verifiable and every detail is true.
Yeah, I think you
So
had a
that's
footnote in your first paragraph, if I remember correctly.
yeah,
You were
well,
footnoting right away.
you have to, I kind of found like you have to, because if you don't, if there's one thing that you get wrong, then the reader has, frankly, the right to question everything in the book. How would they know? If you got, again, the color of the sky on a particular day wrong, then how would they assume that everything else you write in the book is true? So I really tried to make sure that every detail in the book, and there are a lot, because I think that brings the stories to life, is the details. And they always say God is in the details. That's fiction is so interesting because it has these details. So I tried to really bring in details that brought that story to life, but every one of those details has to be true. And if you mess up one, hopefully I didn't, but if you mess up one, it just gives license to the reader to question everything else beyond that. So really, really focused on that. But it's a great question. I mean, everything I did in this book was from that standpoint of try to make it sound like fiction, because that's what I think readers love.
So you mentioned the structure earlier and trying to figure out how you're going to tell this story. And what was your strategy in structuring this, right? You have this class, you told us why you decided on this class, and you want to show how these people were changed. So what was your strategy there?
It's kind of a convoluted strategy, but I think ultimately it worked. So the way I wanted to do it was go a war in four parts. So the first part was going to be their time at the Naval Academy, and I was going to introduce the structure of the academy, how it really kind of inculcated service and honor and expertise into all of the midshipmen through that are there. And I also thought it would be a good time to introduce some of the characters while they were young at the academy. So part one was the academy. And then there's this brief period of time, like I mentioned, between the academy and when the war starts. I wanted that to be a chapter. Initially, part one was going to be just on the academy, and it was this 250 page section of the book, and that didn't work out. So we needed to really shorten that part. But then the war started. And I had this idea of introducing, going chronologically through the war, but each part, so the first part is on the waves, and that's graduates who are in the surface fleet. The second part is above the waves, and that's midshipmen graduates who are flying off of aircraft carriers in these great naval air battles of World War II. And then part three was going to be beneath the waves, and that was the graduates who were on the submarines. And it worked out really well because, again, I could stick to that kind of chronological flow. It allowed me to focus on graduates and midshipmen who did all sorts of various things, submarines, planes, blimps, surface ships. And it allowed me to kind of also then go chronologically. So it all really kind of came together well, I think. Starts with Pearl Harbor, ends with a submarine out at sea when the the bombs are dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, so we can kind of close the book that way. And then every chapter is a different graduate.
Hey, no
So,
spoiler alerts. We don't want to know how the war ended up.
yeah, right. There's a lot of suspense there. But the thing I really liked about the book is every chapter starts with a picture of the graduate, their senior class, first classman year at the academy. So the reader gets a sense of what these folks look like. And I included a brief description from the yearbook of each one of these members. And what they did was every midshipman who graduated that year, and they still do this, their roommate would write up, or one of their suite mates, or just a really good friend of theirs would write up a brief paragraph about that person. Really well written, very interesting, gives a really good kind of background on these individuals in the book. And so I had to include that. And I think it really does help. A lot of people tell me that's their favorite part of the book is those brief write-ups, which is interesting because that's the one part that I didn't write. I just brought it in there from somewhere else. But it is a very interesting and I think cool way to introduce each one of these characters. Yeah, each one of these
It
people.
was really smart to do that because it makes them real people, and
Yeah.
it immediately just gives you a sense of the character. And then,
Good.
and
Yeah.
that, which increases the stakes, right? Like it makes
Right.
everything like more
Exactly.
serious. So now you mentioned like having to cut so many people out of this. How did you decide on the people you focused on?
Ultimately, is the story riveting, compelling? Did they do something, interesting? And then it was this, did it fit within that structure that I was talking about? Did it fit in a theater that I wanted to talk about? Was it a role that I wanted to talk about? Was this person at Midway doing something that was interesting at Midway? Were they on subs? So it kind of ultimately had to check each one of those boxes. But also, did I have enough research material on these people? And there were a lot of stories where I just didn't have the material, so couldn't use it. But if the person kind of matched all those criteria and had put out memoirs or had conducted some interviews, unfortunately, everybody had passed away before I started writing this book, which is my big regret. But it had a lot of criteria that it had to match. So, and in a lot of ways, it was dictated to me. It wasn't me selecting people, it was me saying, okay, every one of those details that I need, every one of those criteria, this person fits, so they're going into the book. But I didn't want, so a lot of times in the each chapter, I'll include maybe a brief aside about another member of the graduating class that year. And one of them was a pilot who fought at the Coral Sea and disappeared over the seas, disappeared in the middle of a dogfight. We don't know what happened to him. But I wanted to include a bit about him because he still was there, and he still his story, even though it's very slight, there's a lot of unknown. I just felt like it deserved to be told. He needed to be mentioned. So sometimes I would just say, this person who disappeared still needs to be in the book, even though I don't know much about him, and even though I don't know what he did, or even though Brink Bass, for instance, it was kind of an outlier in terms of where he was in the world when the war was going on. But sometimes the stories were just so uniquely interesting that I brought them in anyway, and just took a paragraph or a couple pages to write about them too. So it was a bit convoluted, frankly. It's ultimately the criteria that I used to select from was pretty complex, but again, I think it worked out.
No, it's complicated and it's hard, right? It's hard to
Yeah.
cut things when you hear good stories or you hear moments or really colorful characters, right? But they don't fit into the overall work. I mean, those are hard decisions, but you have to make them. What were some of the, I guess, what were some of the most interesting stories? Like, when you're talking to kids, or where you're going out and telling people about the book, what was like maybe one of the ones that struck you the most? It was one of the most interesting stories.
It's interesting. It all kind of, I mean, I have my certain sort of favorite stories from the book that I always think about. And one of them was Ethan Allen, who was a graduate of the Academy, was an aviator when the war started, was on the Enterprise on the day of Pearl Harbor, when the Enterprise was not in the harbor, but it was close by out at sea. And he and his squadron was ordered to land at Pearl Harbor that night, so the night after the attack. And They knew it was a bad idea to try to land at Pearl Harbor at night right after this attack. They knew everybody would be jumpy. Everybody would be riled up and upset, and it was probably a dangerous place to try to land in. But this squadron of planes went in and tried to land, and sure enough, as they're coming in, anti-aircraft fire, guys with rifles who aren't, is this a another Japanese wave or not? We have no idea. Started to fire on these planes. And so Ethan Allen was shot down over Pearl Harbor that night. A bullet hit him in the side. He actually was able to parachute and kind of swim through the oily water and get to a hospital, but he passed away at the hospital. So, and I had no idea that happened. And I think it's an interesting angle on the Pearl Harbor raid, kind of that night after the attack when the fires are still blazing and oil is still coating the water, and the destroyer and the battleships are still lying at their odd angles or rolled over, and just a horrible time. And one of the class of 38 was there that night and was part of that event, and it was an event I had never heard of. So that was kind of one of the stories. The other one is Ernie Cody and what happened to him, where he was a blimp pilot, and it's kind of one of the great mysteries of the war. He went out with his co-pilot, flew the blimp off the coast of California. And an hour later, an hour or two later, the blimp floats back over the coast, over the beach, and crash lands in Daly City. And the firefighters go and rip the door open because they assume the two pilots are in the blimp, and Ernie Cody and his co-pilot are gone. And they don't know where they went. They don't know what happened to them. Really interesting story. People love stories like that, those kinds of missing person stories. And the kids at school, when I talk at schools, they love that story because there are pictures of the blimp flying over the coast of California. And so we kind of talk about what do they think kind of happened to it. And there's a whole backstory about, what might have happened and fishermen seeing the blimp over the water doing odd things. So that's a real fun story. And then one of my favorite characters, just because he was such an amazing person, is Frank Lynch. He was this big guy, an amazing athlete at the academy. Was the highest ranking midshipman his first class year, his senior year, was on a submarine, became an executive officer, was part of this legendary patrol, became a captain of the submarine, earned Navy crosses, had these amazing war patrols where he was taking his sub in all of these really dangerous places. And his is kind of a tragic story because he was destined, they say, to be Chief of Naval Operations, not just an admiral, but probably the one of the highest ranking admirals in the Navy. But he got into a car accident in the 50s and lost his eye. He was riding in a taxi cab, and the taxi got into a car accident. And that effectively ended his career after all of these amazing things that he had done during the war, which I was kind of was interested in because it just shows the chances of life, the vagaries of life, the oddities of life that just happen sometimes. And I think people kind of resonate with that because it's such a tragedy. It's so sad, I mean, all these people had amazing stories during the war, but then they also had stories after the war. And that allows me to kind of talk about later in their careers what happened to these folks. So I think those are just three of the characters that I remember and still think about a lot.
You're just igniting the fiction writer in me by like the people missing from the blimp, right? Like that's a great writing prompt. I might have to
It's
take you
really
up on
cool.
that.
And again, it's one of those stories I had never heard about. I mean, I spent my whole life reading about World War II, and so many of these stories I never knew about.
Yeah, I
And
never heard
so,
about that flying into the airfield. I mean, the airfields were all pockmarked, right, with bombs and
oh,
wreckage. There were still people trapped in the ship.
wreckage everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine someone saying, let's fly in at night.
And they hadn't taken every precaution. They all knew that this squadron, and given the attitude of all of the sailors in the harbor that night, this squadron is flying in at dark. It's not a good idea. We shouldn't be doing this. But they were running low on fuel, and they couldn't land on the carrier again. They couldn't land on the Enterprise, so they had to land somewhere. So they were sent back to Pearl Harbor anyway. And there were announcements made. This flight coming in is our Americans. Don't fire on these planes coming in. I mean, there were announcements, there were messages that were sent out, and still, they say one person on the Pennsylvania was likely the first person that fired on the planes. And once that fired, it lit up the entire harbor
Yeah.
with anti-aircraft fire. And and three pilots died. Some landed and were the planes were all shot up. I mean, it was just a really sad story that I never knew about.
So when you mentioned the guy in the accident in the taxi, in your research, did you notice or did you take note of how often just like chance plays a role in combat and who survives and who doesn't? Like
Oh,
people, I
it's
think they have
yeah.
Rambo in their heads, you know, and they're thinking like, you know,
Right.
but so much of it is just you're standing in the wrong place at the wrong time.
It's exactly right. You're on a submarine that just disappears, and it's a submarine. There's no difference from that submarine from any other submarine. Some of the pilots, they would fly out and everything would go fine, and they would be on their way back, and they would make a navigational error, maybe be 1 degree off, and they would miss the aircraft carrier. And they wouldn't find it again, and they would crash land in the sea, and that would be it. Nobody knew what would happen to them. I mean, the vagaries, the chance. Every day, every one of these sailors, every one of the soldiers during World War II had to deal with that. And there was no getting around it, and no amount of preparation could mitigate it. I mean, the impact of chance. I don't think this is unique to World War II, but certainly in World War II, where the technology isn't great. They're doing a lot of things kind of in a, just because they haven't prepared well enough, or because they, their commander isn't a very good commander. But every day it seemed like they were dealing with things that could have resulted in their death. And it's just amazing that as many survived that did.
I mean, these are really powerful stories. What is it you're hoping the reader comes away with after they finish this book?
Well, I think two things. One is just a pride in the service, the military service, a pride in the people who volunteer, the people who are even drafted but serve. I hope in this day and age that it reinstills in people a sense of this country is still a pretty amazing country. And then the kind of the second thing I hope it does is it reminds people that history is really interesting and full of really good stories that I didn't know about. So I hope it encourages people to kind of go back and study the history of this country. I think they'll be rewarded if they do so.
Were there techniques or resources that you used when you were researching that you think would be helpful to other people writing, whether it's nonfiction or historical fiction?
Yeah, so I found I had to go to the Naval Academy. I had to walk around. You just kind of have to have that sense as often as you can. I think every nonfiction historian, does this just as a matter of course, and certainly recognizes the importance of being there where something happened. So I think that's one of the things. The second thing is, it is amazing in this day and age how everything seems to be digitized, or at least everything you really need. I needed a lot of primary military documents, and that is all online. And it's not very expensive to find. You just have to be sort of patient. The National Archives, the Library of Congress have great online, repositories of all this information. I used a site called Fold3. Very easy to get a subscription. It's very cheap. And they have every official military document you can think of. I found so many really rich resources that had been digitized, that were easily available online. And that's how I found out, what the sky was like the day Midway happened, or what the plane number was of this person's plane, so I could include that detail in there. I mean, it's all in these official reports that are, again, pretty easy to find. So, I don't use AI, but I certainly use technology to help make this problem, I mean, to help make this project and this research more manageable.
But I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice when you talk about the research. So, like, how do you know when you're researching just because you enjoy the research? And maybe that's not a bad thing by itself, right? Like the final product is not the whole goal; it's a process, as we talked about. But how do you know, like, when enough is enough? Like with the research, like how do you know
That's
when
a
to
great
say, okay, I
question.
got to write?
So I tend to do it this way. So I'm writing my second book. I'm just about to finish the research. What I have found is that once I have about 1,000 pages of notes, pretty small font, 1,000 pages in Word, I know I've got enough to tell a 300, 350-page book. So that's kind of my goal, is to have, and it's really a silly way of doing it, but it kind of helps me know, okay, And 1,000 pages is a lot. And and what I've also found is that sometimes I have 2 pages of notes that will give me maybe 2 sentences in the book, or maybe just some background that I need. Maybe it doesn't even come into the book, or maybe it's just, again, one word, maybe a personality description, or maybe I include it in a in the kind of the tactical explanation of what happened. But research is funny. I mean, and I'm always kind of looking out for good quotes, and some of these quotes can be in the most dry documents. I mean, every after every submarine patrol, the captain will put together a war report, and I found so many good quotes from this war report, and I would pull that in. So it's all kind of very I think, I'm sort of going all over the place with the research, but there is no one way to do the research. I don't think there's one way to organize the research. I've really tried to be careful with the citations and make sure every one of those is correct. Make sure I'm never changing around the details or the facts or a quote to suit my needs. You don't want to do that. But I think it's okay for people to go overboard with the research. You got to organize it well. You're going to need to organize it efficiently. But you're right. You could spend so much time researching that you never get to the writing phase. So you do have to know when you've done enough. And in my experience, that tends to be when I've hit about 1,000 pages of notes.
That's a
And
lot.
those notes could be, sometimes it's I photocopy a page from a war report, and that'll be one page. It's just in my experience, that tends to kind of be okay. You can now start to think about writing. Now, a lot of times you're writing and you'll need to go back and find something you didn't have or do more research on this topic that you thought you had done enough on. So there's always willing, you always got to be willing to adapt. But
Is
that's
there
kind
like
of how
a
I do it.
When you're doing this research, like you're pulling up these war reports, do you find there's like this magic in that you're looking, a commander wrote something at the end of like a submarine patrol, and maybe nobody has read this thing since the war. And now he's reaching across time. He's dead, right? Reaching across time to you, and you're kind of experiencing this through him, right? The same way people who are reading your book will experience this kind of magic.
I'm pretty sure I was the first person to look at some of these documents in maybe, 80 years. But it's just so much fun. Yeah, and the more obscure the document, in some ways, the more fun it is to kind of go through it. The more it's really exciting to have a document that may, you're pretty sure nobody's really looked at. And it gives you some details about something, maybe about it's the Pearl Harbor raid, or maybe it's Midway, that you think people are going to be surprised by. And so that's kind of always exciting. I loved memoirs. I loved interviews because that would allow me to put the writer into that person's head, which can be hard to, it would just impossible to do if you don't have that. And a lot of history doesn't do that. Oral history, I always thought can be a bit of a challenge. I listened to a lot of oral history. The Naval Archives, I mean, I'm sorry, the Library of Congress did a lot of interviewing of veterans, and other places have too. But that you kind of have to be a bit careful of because in a lot of these instances, you know that the gentleman is just not remembering very well or not maybe getting some of the details wrong. And so okay, this is good. But I'm going to need to verify some of this and I'm going to need to double check. And so oral history is valuable, but it also kind of needs to be part, not the only thing that you use for sure. But yeah, to your point exactly, going through the documents is just a lot of fun and so much good detail in there. And when you, like I said, when you're using something or looking at something that you're pretty sure no one's really looked at in a long time, that's when it really gets exciting.
It's like a window into the past, right?
Yes, it really is. It's unvarnished history, which in this day and age is hard to find, it's raw, it's real, it's unvarnished, it's authentic, and that's the best kind of research, the best kind of sources.
Were there, you had a, you have a family, you have a full-time job, right? You're doing all this unbelievably research intensive project. Did you have any like tips that you can give to writers about how you developed your writing practice? Were there times a day, word counts that you wrote to? Were there, what did you do to keep yourself going to get to the end of this book?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I thought a lot about it. And it seems to be every writer that I've heard talk about it has a bit of a different approach to it. Mine was really the only time I could do it would be, I always sort of said, okay, 8:30 to 10:30, 8:30 to 11 is my time to do this. And it's still, even though my kids are now older and I can do it whenever after the, work day, I still kind of stick to that. I do it at night. I don't do it by, okay, I have to have so many words. I have to have so many pages of research notes. I just kind of do it as focus for 2.5, 2 hours. Don't miss a day. Do it as, as many days a week as you can, and just be disciplined with not taking any days off. And I have found that the work just really starts to compound and you really start to make good progress if you kind of stick to that. So in the writing process, again, I don't hold myself to you got to have X number of words, you got to have X number of pages. I know a lot of writers do that, and that's great. I think it's just another way of saying I've got to be disciplined about this. And so kind of the approach I take is whatever happens within 2 hours, 2.5 hours each day, that's a good effort. As long as you stay focused, don't get distracted. Maybe you find one document in 2.5 hours, or maybe you write 12 pages in 2.5 hours. Either one of those is a good day because you spent, the needed time each day to maintain momentum.
That is great advice. If you're working every day, you will get the book finished.
You will get it done. Yeah. May
So,
take a while, but it's interesting now having a deadline. I didn't have a deadline with the first book. On the second one I'm writing now, I have a deadline. So if things are changing a little bit, in the sense that I need to be a bit more cognizant of the progress I'm making than I was before. But so far, so good. It's working out.
A lot of authors talk about that sophomore book and how different it is. You have your lifetime to write book one, the next one's on contract and you can't be late, right? So how has that created a level of like stress or discomfort in your writing, and has it affected your process at all, or the opposite? Is it motivating and that it just, I mean, it sounds like you're very disciplined to begin with.
So it's not. It's not motivating. It is a bit more stressful, yeah, to have this deadline, to have this contract that I've signed. It hasn't reduced the enjoyment at all. It has made those times when I can't spend on the book each day a bit more frustrating. Get a little cranky. I think my wife will tell you if I have to miss a night of work for one particular reason, but I think having the deadline has helped. And I know it's amazing how much better I think I am at identifying the research I need, finding the research I need, capturing the research I need. So much better now than I was the first time. So that's really, really helped. And it's fun because I think I'm to the point now where I'm about to start writing. And the research process was a lot easier the second time around because I knew how to do it, I think. So far, I feel like I'm on track. I feel like, the deadline's gonna I'm gonna have no problems hitting the deadline, and it's been a bit more stressful, but not too bad.
They say that Malcolm Gladwell, 10,000 hours of mastery in any subject is about 1 million words for writers, and it's certainly for researching, right? These are all techniques. And so it does get easier as you go, but the problem is the goalposts keep moving because you keep becoming a better writer, so you keep tackling new, challenges as you go,
And would love to hear, your thoughts on this. But there's a lot of pressure, I think, to make the second book at least as good as the first one, if not light years better than the first one. And I get the sense from folks that expectations rise with each book that comes out. You certainly don't want to disappoint people. So I'm feeling it, from a the writing's going to have to be as good, and the writing's going to have to be maybe even better, and the research is going to have to be as good, or if not better. So I get the sense that, step backs are not allowed in this business.
You know what though, you can get into your head with that. I mean, I think you hit the beginning of this, you really hit on you connect with your joy, connect with your passion for the history you're telling. If you're enjoying what you're writing, you will find your readership. They will enjoy it too. Write this book for yourself and they will love it too. So
And
can you tell us
that's what
what
I haven't lost that. That joy is still here, which I think is a good thing.
it's so important. What is the subject matter of this book? Are you free to say or no?
Well, I think I am. The book is going to be about Peleliu, which was a island in the Pacific, and it was one of the islands that the Marines invaded. So it's another book about World War II. It's another military history. I'm going to write it in very much. This is going to be a bit more of a tactical description of what happened, but told in my writing style and my voice, very research heavy. It's going to tell the story about, the Marines, the 1st Marine Division, and what happened to them during this battle. And it was one of those battles that, was supposed to take 3 days, wind up taking 2 months. It's very interesting because it's not well known. It's not like Iwo Jima. The Japanese defended the island in a different way than they had prior to that. And there was just so many, again, interesting stories to tell about this battle. A lot of books have been written about it, but I think there's still more, more that can be said. And it was a book that the publisher, Naval Institute Press, said, think about doing this. And I had heard about it, but I did a little bit of kind of thinking about it and said, yeah, this is a subject that I really can get passionate about. Those battles and those stories, the stories of the amphibious and operations during World War II were just, I don't know how people did it. I don't know how they had the courage to do it. I don't know how they survived it. How they overcame the fear that they must have felt as the landing craft are going into the beach. I'm never going to know what that's like, but I can research it and research it and research it and get a sense of it and try to tell that to try to keep those stories alive, try to convey those feelings to readers today. That's the least I can do. So I'm excited about it. It's going well.
Yeah, the
It's got to
courage
be,
is definitely.
it's got to be short. So it's going to have to be tight. It's going to have to be, shorter than scattered far and wide. So though, again, there's going to be a lot that I have to cut out, and that's going to be the, a challenging part of it, but it's a fun part of it. None of this is not fun. No part of this is not fun, I've found.
That is the right attitude. And I thank you for doing this and keeping this history alive. I can't wait for this next book. And I
Thank
hope
you.
some of the things that you cut out of the first book show up as reader magnets or as individual essays or, short stories or
They
something.
should. I need to do that. I need to focus on that. But to your point, we were talking about it before the show. It's hard to find the time, isn't it? And I need to get less sleep and more work done. That's what I need to do.
So where can viewers go to find your work?
Naval Institute Press. It's also up on Amazon. It's on Barnes and Noble, bookshop.org. If you want to buy, go through some independent channels to find it. It's in some bookshops. I know certain Barnes and Nobles have it. Some not others don't. I'm not sure how that exactly is working, but online it's easily found.
Well, congratulations. This is really,
Thank you.
really, really well written and certainly
Thank you.
fascinating subject matter. So congratulations.
Jeffrey, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Talking to you and hearing that from you just means the world to me, truly.
Well, it's an honor to talk to you, and I hope you will come back and we'll do this again, maybe in person
I
at
would love it.
Elaine's when you have the second book done.
I would love it. That would be a lot of fun. We'll have to talk about that. But thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care.